weeks of political theater, Mr. Smith goes to Obscuristan. It's a hilarious barbed satire driven by current events. The performance will be held on Wednesday, October 2nd at the Tower Theater and is sponsored by the Fresno Free College Foundation, KFCF Radio, and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Tickets are available at the Tower Box Office, 815 East Olive Avenue at Moroa. They're open 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday and 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday. For convenience, you may charge tickets by phone at 559-485-9050. That's 485-9050. We could all use a good laugh.
After war, legal experts say the proposal appears to be broader than an Iraq resolution passed by the Congress in 1998 and may be more sweeping than the measure giving Bush's father authority to fight the Persian Gulf War. Iraq has taken its case directly to the United Nations General Assembly. Its foreign minister declares that Iraq is clear of all nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. He criticized the U.S. for trying to link Iraq to the September 11th attacks. President Bush says he did not have to listen to Iraq's foreign minister address to the United Nations to know what happened. Bush says it's the same old song and dance. It's day two on Capitol Hill, where two congressional committees are looking into intelligence lapses before the September 11th attacks. Two Bush administration officials testified today that they were well aware Osama bin Laden might try to attack Americans, but nobody knew where, when, or how. Yasser Arafat is once again confined to his West Bank office, and Israeli tanks are making sure he doesn't leave. The tanks rolled in after another suicide bombing in Israel. This one left five people dead when a bomber set his explosives off on a bus in the heart of Tel Aviv. Israeli troops shot to death a Palestinian teenager today who broke curfew to buy his father some cigarettes. Representatives of West Coast ports say they will close down the biggest complex in the country beginning tomorrow unless the union immediately ends an alleged slowdown. The Pacific Maritime Association says unless operations return to normal, workers will be shut out at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach at 7 a.m. tomorrow. The union denies it's engaging in a work slowdown, saying there's just too much work and not enough trained employees to handle it at those two ports. Attorneys for the California School Employees Association today appealed a juvenile court judge's decision to report an immigrant youth to the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which then deported him. The lawyers argued that the judge's decision is unconstitutional and could have a disastrous impact on immigrant youth all over the state. Details on these and other stories coming up in the KPFA Evening News at 6. Stay tuned now for Flashpoints.
Today on Flashpoints, the U.S. stonewalls on an international convention against the creation and use of biological warfare. Also, more analysis on the real politics behind the drive towards war against Iraq, and an update on the Israeli occupation of Palestine in anticipation of a major national protest against that occupation. And from New York City, The Night Report, I'm Dennis Bernstein, all this straight ahead on Flashpoints. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We now go to New York City for the Night Report with Robert Knight.
In today's report, a bloody attempted coup in the Ivory Coast, a bomb in Tel Aviv, and more Israeli tanks in Ramallah, and a full court press for war in Iraq. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Key cities in the Ivory Coast remain under curfew tonight, following an attempted coup that has left nearly 100 mutinous soldiers dead, including rebel General Robert Gueye, the leader of a 1999 coup d'etat. Also killed was Cote d'Ivoire's interior minister. The uprising among troops under forced retirement came as the president was in Italy. The pre-dawn rebellion had been suppressed in the capital of Abidjan at press time, and also continues to have skirmishes in the towns of Korhogo and Bouake, which is the second largest city in the former French colony that is the world's main producer of cocoa. In Tel Aviv, five were killed, and 60 wounded in a bus-based suicide bombing, the second in 2 days, following failures to establish a phased Israeli withdrawal from occupied Palestinian territories. The Palestinian Authority has condemned the attack, whose responsibility was claimed by Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and the Al-Quds Brigades. In retaliation, Israeli troops have once again surrounded and sequestered Palestinian Authority Chair Yasser Arafat at his Ramallah headquarters, shooting dead at least one Palestinian and demanding the surrender of 24 more. Meanwhile, after an unwelcome victory at the United Nations, in which Iraq has agreed to the return of weapons inspectors withdrawn 4 years ago, the Bush administration is now seeking to thwart the UN process, which could take months to complete, by demanding war powers from Congress. According to United Nations Resolution 1284, inspectors will need 60 more days to decide on what they need to do on the ground in Iraq. Then the inspections themselves would only begin in early March and last 6 months until the end of September. Accordingly, the Secretary of State, General Colin Powell, joined a White House cavalcade to the Congress, which is expected to vote on authorizing a military action in Iraq without a formal declaration of war. Powell then returned to the United Nations today to press the Security Council members, including Russia, who say that no new punitive resolutions are needed against Iraq, that the existing ones are sufficient. And in a letter delivered to the United Nations today, Saddam Hussein declared that Iraq is clear of all nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons of mass destruction, and he welcomed the return of inspectors, but said that is as long as they honor Iraqi sovereignty and security. Hussein added that, quote, the U.S. administration wants to destroy Iraq in order to control Middle East oil and constantly control the politics as well as the oil and economic policies of the whole world, end quote. And finally, White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer said today that it was, quote, outrageous and inexplicable, end quote, that Germany's justice minister made a historical comparison to the Bush administration's expanding military policy by saying, quote, Bush wants to divert attention from his domestic problems. It is a classic tactic. It is one that Hitler used, end quote. And that is some of the news of Thursday, September 19, 2002. In New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoint.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We now go briefly to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange. Medea, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hey, Dennis.
Well, I think I heard your voice yesterday. Were you giving testimony before the House, or what was going on there?
Yes, I was asking questions of Donald Rumsfeld.
And what kind of questions were you raising? You actually were taken out of there when you tried to speak.
Well, I did get some questions out. Of course, I didn't have time to get the answers. This was Donald Rumsfeld testifying before the House Armed Services Committee yesterday morning. And as he started droning through his presentation about how attacking Iraq was the only thing that we could do to ensure security in the United States, I got up and started asking questions like how many Iraqi civilians is he willing to kill, how many U.S. service people, isn't this all about oil, why is he doing this around election time, don't we have a better use for $100 billion, and how is he going to protect us from the backlash of anti-American sentiment that this attack is going to create.
So, he did respond. He said that this is a perfect example of how the United States believes in free speech, and he was delighted that we have this possibility, unlike Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
Yes, and then went on to lie, of course, to talk about Iraq kicking out the weapons inspectors, and that's why we can't rely on inspections. And, of course, he doesn't say that so many of our allies throughout the Middle East, you wouldn't have the right of free speech as well, but we don't intend to go and bomb our allies like the Saudis or the Kuwaitis.
Did the police take you out cordially?
They were extremely nice. It's funny, Dennis, because we had been advised by D.C. lawyers that it was a very dangerous thing to do, that we would be held overnight, that we would be given a court date, that it would be a heavy fine, maybe even a jail sentence. And the police took us out so nicely, interrogated us for maybe a half an hour, but let us go without even arresting us. And you could tell that there was a sentiment there that they really appreciated what we were doing. In fact, one of them said, you know, we're not allowed to have opinions, but when it comes to dealing with people like Saddam Hussein, sometimes you get more with honey than you do with vinegar.
Well, we only have a minute left.
Tomorrow we are going at 7 o'clock in the morning to the home of Senator Daschle, who has the ability to keep this vote from coming up in the Senate as a Democrat in control of the Senate. And we're going to do a wake-up call. We're going to be out there saying, wake up, Democrats, stop Bush's war, represent your constituents, we don't want war.
All right. Well, Medea, I guess if people are listening on the Internet and they want to join you, they can do that. And perhaps you can keep us posted in terms of maybe the senator will come out and join you for breakfast.
Well, you know, Dennis, the main thing, any time to help, we need help at Global Exchange and organizing all these actions around the country. So please consider giving us a little bit of your time in these difficult days and call Global Exchange at 415-255-7296.
All right. Well, we hope that you enjoy your breakfast, and I hope that the senator hears the wake-up call. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis. Take care.
And you are listening to Flashpoints. In the past 2 years of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, thousands of Palestinians have been killed. Meanwhile, the occupation has expanded, and home demolitions and extrajudicial executions have also continued unabated. Also, Israel has continued to close cities, schools, displace thousands of Palestinians. Join us to talk about the impact of the ongoing occupation and also about a major national protest that is coming up is attorney Ramez Rafidi. Ramez Rafidi is on the board of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee in San Francisco, and he is an Arab American activist. Welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Dennis.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you with us. It is a difficult time, though, for those who are living in Palestine. Now, why don't you just give us a general update on life on the ground there these days?
Well, for the Palestinians, life on the ground is very monotonous. For the last about 6 to 7 weeks, most of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have been under complete lockdown, meaning Palestinians are not allowed out of their homes. Just today, a young Palestinian, 13-year-old, broke curfew, went to go buy a pack of cigarettes for his father, and was shot killed. The effect that the curfew and the closure has had on the Palestinian economy has been devastated, and even the USAID, which is a quasi-American governmental organization, has conducted a study in the Gaza Strip and has found that a quarter of Palestinian children are now malnourished as a result. A quarter of Palestinian children are now malnourished as a direct result of these policies implemented by the Israeli army. And most of the time, you know, famine and malnourishment is a result of, you know, acts of Mother Nature. But in this instant, it's a deliberate attempt by the Israelis to starve the Palestinians into submission.
And there has been no let up on extrajudicial executions. There have been some pretty horrific executions carried out in the last couple of months. Could you just give us a sense of that?
Yeah, absolutely not. There has been no let up. You're completely right about that. And as a matter of fact, there has been an increase. And the policy of the Israelis is to get their men and the consequences be damned. And we saw a graphic example of that in the Gaza Strip when an Israeli F-16 targeted an apartment building full of civilians, and a Hamas activist, Shahada, bombed the building, killed 15 innocent civilians along with the Hamas activist. So it's a policy of, you know, hitting their men, getting their men, and any incidental collateral damage is of no moment to the Israeli government or the Israeli army.
There was also the killings of some stonecutters who were sort of apparently executed at close range. Are any of these instances really investigated?
They're sham investigations, and they're investigations that are not committed by the Israeli army under its own cognizance, but rather by pressure from, you know, liberal elements within Israeli society, within liberal newspapers that actually put pressure on the Israeli government to investigate these killings. With regards to the stonecutters that you referred to, there was an internal investigation within the army. No Palestinian witnesses were called, of course. And the army, the IDF, exonerated the Israeli troops that executed these four stonecutters because, according to the soldiers, they looked suspicious.
And I believe in the case of the dropping of the 1,000-pound bomb, I guess it was, from the U.S.-made F-16, the Israelis thought that was actually a proper and important operation.
Oh, absolutely. They were not apologetic about it. I mean, as I stated before, you know, the consequences be damned. What they wanted was the death of this person, the fact that he was there with his family, the fact that there were dozens of families living within that pretty crowded place of the Gaza Strip was completely insignificant. And it reflects an attitude on the part of the Israeli government that the Palestinians are somehow subhuman and that they're indispensable, that they're, you know, that their mothers and their fathers don't cry for the death of their children. And this is how you get policies like that with the killing of, you know, mass amounts of people.
Now, September is an important day in the lives of Palestinians for several reasons, an important month. Could you talk about that?
Sure. September is an important month for two reasons, both incidentally involving the current Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon. September is relevant because this month marks the second year of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, which was, of course, precipitated by Sharon's, you know, nose-thumbing visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, which provoked the Palestinians and Arabs across the Middle East. It's also relevant because September 18th through the 20th marks the massacre of Palestinian refugees in the Sabra Shatila camps. Actually, on this date, September 19th, 20 years ago, was the second day of the three-day-long massacre. That was precipitated by Ariel Sharon also. He was the Israeli defense minister. He was found by his own people as being responsible for the massacres, and he was forced to resign in shame. And this is the same man that the Israelis overwhelmingly elected last year.
This is KFCF in Fresno, listener-supported non-commercial radio for the Central San Joaquin Valley. And good afternoon, and welcome to our live broadcast from City Hall. And we are just a few minutes late getting started here, as sometimes is known to happen. We had a few technical problems getting on the air. We were going to be starting at 5, but obviously we're a few minutes late. I'm Rich Withers. Along with me is Lee Abernathy, who is on the one of our board members and has also been involved in our community and working in the law enforcement division of our community. And she's also worked in theater and a lot of other things, and she will be interviewing some people down below. And what we're doing a live broadcast today is the Police Auditor Forum. Teresa Gutierrez-Daly is here, who is the independent police auditor for San Jose. And she will be making a presentation to members of the community here today, and that will be taking place here in just a few minutes. I had a chance earlier today to talk to a few other people about the independent police auditor programs in some other communities. And first we have an interview that took place with the chief of police of San Jose. Sure.
My tape rolling. Okay. How do you feel about the independent police auditor program in San Jose? How's it been there?
We've had the independent police program in San Jose for about 8 years now, and it's been a very effective means of modifying policy and procedures and making changes within the organization that makes us more professional and works better with the community.
Now, did you originally have a lot of resistance from the police officers out on the street to the program?
The program was initiated by the mayor and council at the time, and they, through a vote, put it in place and got very little resistance from it.
Okay. Were there any things along the way that you'd have done differently in the way the program was set up, things to watch out for in initiating it?
And, you know, I'm very comfortable with the program we have here. I think it's a very successful system of police oversight for a law enforcement agency.
Did you have any bumps along the way?
No, we have not.
And what would you say have been the major benefits to the program for San Jose?
Well, there's two major benefits. It gives the community an opportunity to make reports and have investigations take place and reviewed in an atmosphere that, to some community members, is more user-friendly. The other thing it is, it has a review process that goes directly to the city manager and then to the mayor and the council. So you get outside review by elected officials of law enforcement conduct.
You feel the public feels a little more trusting of having an outside review rather than something internal to the police department?
Oh, very much so. It's been a real asset to the San Jose Police Department.
Has there also been a benefit in terms of a reduced number of lawsuits and the cost of those lawsuits?
Yeah, I think a good example of how well the program works for us in the last 2 years, our complaint rate has been reduced by almost 40%.
And you've also had fewer incidents, haven't you?
Pardon?
You've also had fewer incidents of police shootings and stuff, haven't you?
They're way down here in the city of San Jose, and it's a recommendation that came from the police auditor that has a review process of every single officer-involved shooting with a recommendation that comes out of it for training or equipment, which has been very, very effective for us.
And what changes have they made in equipment and training?
We have put in place here a critical incident team to deal with the mentally ill. We find out that in law enforcement shootings, a very large percent, about 70%, involve people with mental issues. And the officers have learned through a training process to be able to manage those better. We put non-lethal equipment in on the cars here in the city of San Jose so the officers have options that are immediately available. And then we've done a training scenario where the officers operate better as a team and the sergeants are required to go to calls like that. We found that if a sergeant gets on scene, the opportunity of having an officer-involved shooting is reduced by almost 90%. But you got to get them there quick. One of the other things we found in our review process is that if there's going to be an officer-involved shooting, it will occur within the first 15 minutes. So whatever options that you put in place to prevent that from occurring, that's more safer for the citizen or the officer, you've got to be able to get that resource there within 15 minutes, which is a change in policy and procedure, and it requires additional resources to do that.
Does the auditor's department work with other police agencies such as sheriff or highway patrol in the area at all, or how does that work?
No, the independent police auditor works directly for the mayor and the council of the city of San Jose.
Now, does the sheriff have anything similar?
They do not.
So do they have more officer-related incidents happening and so on?
I couldn't tell you.
You don't really know, okay.
No, but we have the only police review system, independent police auditor system in Santa Clara County. No other agency in our county has either civilian review or police independent auditor.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time.
Okay.
And I appreciate it.
Hey,
and
good luck.
We'll see how it goes down here.
Hey, you got it.
Thanks.
I wish him the best.
Okay.
You bet. Bye.
And that was the chief of police for San Jose, who we had a chance to talk to a little bit earlier today. And this is KFCF in Fresno, listener-supported non-commercial radio for the Central San Joaquin Valley. Can you hear me, Lee?
No, I can't.
Okay, let's see here what's happened to her radio. Oh, yeah, we got it off. 1-2-1-2. 1-2-1-2-1-2.
I'm not supposed to hear you in here?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Well, anyway, we also had a chance. Give me just a second, Lee. We're still trying to work out some technical things here so she can hear me for set up some interviews. I also had a chance to talk to another individual who is with the Sacramento police auditor, independent police auditor. And here's that interview.
Okay, and you are the independent auditor for Sacramento. How long have you had the program in Sacramento?
It's been about 3 years, and it's called the Office of Police Accountability.
And what has been the general feeling from the police department in terms of the program?
Well, we started in August of 1999, and when we did that, we had a show of support from the police. They actually voiced a support for the office because I think, in large part, they were involved in the discussions regarding the creation of the office. And so there was a level of support that was there when we first started, and that has continued.
Yeah, there wasn't a feeling from the officer on the street that there was somebody looking over their shoulder. I know that's sort of been the reaction here in Fresno at this point.
Have that reaction from some of the officers on the department. And I'm not trying to indicate by any stretch of the imagination that there was 100% support by police officers for the office. And there was not then, and there probably is not now. I'm sure you'll find some officers who don't support the office for one reason or another. But the union and the union leadership made a statement of support for the office initially and continues to support the office today.
What have been some of the accomplishments of the office?
Supported.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said I'm sure some members of the rank and file still have issues with police accountability. I think you're going to find that in any city. But I think the majority of officers, and certainly the police officers union and the union leadership, will support the Office of Police Accountability in Sacramento and do support it.
What are some of the changes the office has made in the police department or recommended to the police department that they've enacted that have been successful?
Well, there are a number of changes that have been recommended. What I might suggest that you do is go to our website and look up the Office of Police Accountability annual reports. In those reports, and there have been two of them thus far, there is a listing of all of the policy recommendations. For example, when we had one incident that involved an officer-involved shooting, there were recommendations that were made to change many of the policies that were there, and that was, in fact, done. And so in the areas of training, a policy recommendation, or any other situation that the office reviews, we have made recommendations that have been honored by the police department that have affected policy and training, the use of force being one of the areas there.
Have they made changes in the police department in terms of having non-lethal force or non-lethal alternatives as a result of your office?
Well, you know, they have always had policies on the books that deal with when force should be used and that sort of thing. I guess one of the biggest changes that have been made is that what we wanted to do was to make certain that policy allowed for alternative courses of actions, and officers understood what those alternative courses were and used force as a final option when that's necessary to protect life. And so in terms of how we impacted that policy, it had to do with additional training regarding options. We also were instrumental in the city, through the city manager's office, directing with the support of the city council that all officers have access to the taser weapon, which is a non-deadly force weapon. We're in the process of making that happen. One of the other major issues that was a result of what we do here in terms of police accountability, we recommended to the city manager, and it was supported by the council and the city manager, that we place cameras in all patrol vehicles, including patrol motorcycles. And this protects both the officer and the citizen in terms of being able to record the activities of officers and their contacts with citizens. So those are two examples of the kinds of recommendations that have come out of the Police Accountability Office that have been implemented.
Has there been a decrease in the number of incidents since your office came into being?
And now when you say incidents, what specifically?
Oh, for example, police-involved shootings and that sort of thing.
Yeah, the first year in the operation of the OPA, we had 6 officer-involved shootings, and I think that the second year there were 6. And so far this year, we have had 2, which would make it down considerably in the last year. Of course, this is September, but we are